Good morning, everybody. Welcome along to class for those of you online. It's great to know you're there. So we'll begin the course as we normally do. For those who know, we start off by taking refuge together and generating an altruistic attitude, engaging the teachings. Then we engage with the course itself, and during that engagement, we have breaks for questions and also for meditation. Let's begin as we normally do by going for refuge to the three jewels and generating the mind of enlightenment. This requires that you first of all become that you are comfortable in your seat. So just check that that is the case. Relax your shoulders if you like, straighten your back. And now you can keep your eyes completely open or let them close. Now you just let your body breathe itself. And as the body breathes itself, just become aware of the movements that take place and any feelings associated with the exhalation and inhalation of breath. Here we just allow the body and the mind to relax and the mind to be focused. So while you continue to breathe normally and naturally, letting the body breathe itself, imagine in the space in front of you and slightly above your eyebrows appears the form of the Buddha. This is Shakyamuni Buddha. He's golden in color. He's wearing a monk's robe and he's sitting on a throne. And surrounding him are the other Buddhas, the other Bodhisattvas, all the other enlightened beings. Now imagine that you're looking up at the Buddha and his spiritual entourage, and you are surrounded by all other sentient beings. These include your parents, family members, people you feel close to, there are strangers there, and there are people you find difficult to be around. Now recollect what you have in common with all the people surrounding you. So all of us have a wish to be happy. None of us wish to experience suffering. And we have the potential to put an end to what causes suffering and realize the happiness that is without any form of suffering at all. So make a decision to put an end to your own suffering and its causes, and to help others do the same. The way to accomplish this is to depend upon or rely upon an authentic teacher, authentic teachings that show you how to abandon suffering and its causes and develop all the good qualities. And of course, we also need to rely upon a spiritual community. I think these forms of reliance are present, that we're going to depend upon setting a safe direction for this life. So join me in saying, I go for refuge until I am enlightened through the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create to listen to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. So wishing to develop our wisdom, our compassion, and other skills to bring about enlightenment and articulate it in this way. In response to this wish of ours, think that from the heart of each enlightened being, lights and nectar stream forth. Lights and nectar wash over you and over all the people surrounding you. And everything that hinders your spiritual path is washed away. The potential for accomplishing everything good is revealed. And you recollect the four immeasurable thoughts of love and compassion and joy and equanimity, and you recite them after me. May all sentient beings have happiness in its causes. May all sentient beings be free from suffering in its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from the bias of attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. And in response to this prayer of ours, again, lots of nectar stream forth from the heart of each enlightened being above you. The lights and nectars wash over you and over all beings surrounding you. And everything that hinders these four immeasurable qualities is swept away. And you find that the love that you presently have, the compassion, the joy and equanimity is now revealed. You recollect the Buddha and the entourage above you. And now you wish to purify any hindrances to your relationship with them and to accumulate every positive quality you possibly can. So before the field bearer, you say, reverently I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and emerging. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since the beginning of this time, and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of psychic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own and others' merits to the great and resident. So now we've purified the mind somewhat, we've accumulated some merit, so we don't want to cling to this, otherwise it'll become problematic. So to stop the clinging, we imagine that every sense object, ourselves, our idea of self, all ideas, all the merit that we've created, everything is utterly transformed through the wisdom realized in selflessness. The phenomena reappear as a wonderful, pure land, whereby we can give teachings to others in the future. And so we're going to offer this pure land to the Buddha and the entourage. And so we say, this ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, sun and moon. I imagine this as a Buddha field of offering my all living beings into this pure land. I think we release the offering and it's been accepted by the Buddha, and he looks at you and smiles at you. And you look up into the face of the Buddha, you meet his gaze. You feel as if every wish you have has been understood and will be actualized. And you feel at ease and accepted. Then the emanation of the Buddha leaves his heart. It moves through space. It comes to the bottom of the crown of your head, facing the same direction you are. Now the emanation begins to descend. It comes down to the level of your heart, whereby it begins to expand, filling your body and mind with light and liquids, nectars. And now these pour out through the pores of your skin and begin to fill the 10 directions of space. And wherever there's a living being, they exist within space. So I think that all these living beings are touched by the light of nectar and utterly transformed into a state of full awakening. There's no difference between self and other. In fact, these words don't even exist in this state. was like a sort of emptiness and also a fullness. Would you just say to hear the mantra of the Buddha? And you begin to recite it, saying, Chayatamuni Mahamudaya Soma. Chayatamuni Mahamudaya Just like this a few times under your breath. I think that every stage of the path has been imprinted upon the mind, which is self and all sentient beings. It's actually been actualized. The heaven light now withdraw from the 10 directions as we enter your heart. And then become aware of the sounds of traffic and the feeling of the solidity of the seat beneath you. And realize that this meditation we've done has been one of imagination. And the idea was to sort of imprint the mind with each stage of the path to awakening. And in depends upon these imprints, we decide to actualize the path to awakening, meaning we really do wish to become fully awakened, have our compassion and our wisdom and all of our skills perfected, so that we can actually help all living beings do the same. I think by being here in this class, this is what we're learning about, and what is the process of freeing ourselves from every affliction and delusion, and what's the state that follows. And now breathing in through your nostrils, exhale through your mouth. And, okay, so this course that we're doing is called Samsara and Nirvana, and we'll work a guide over 8 weeks, and we finish up by doing a sort of review class, and then oftentimes there's some sort of integrated activity we engage in to understand it a bit more deeply. Now, I've relied upon these books here and a number of others as we go through the lessons. So this one down at the bottom here, the four one that's on the, as you're looking at it, must be on your left, called Samsara, Nirvana, and Buddha Nature. So I've primarily relied upon that, but as we go through, of course, I'll take more material from the other books. This, to me, is the most complete explanation of these terms and shows you how you can actually, why it's possible to overcome samsara and its causes and achieve the state called nirvana or liberation. What we're going to talk about today, because as I said, there's not much, but it might feel like a lot by the time we finish. Today's topics, we're going to look at what does this term samsara mean? What's it referring to? We'll look at that and some of the different analogies and similes they use. Then the state of mind you have to create to become free from it. And that state of mind is called renunciation. Now, once you generate the state of mind called renunciation, then you start actually doing the work to free yourself from samsara. And once you're free from samsara, you achieve a state called liberation. So you're liberated from samsara. And once you're completely liberated, or what they also call liberation, another term for that is called nirvana. Now, Nirvana is not the end of the spiritual journey for Mahayana Buddhists. There's another state called enlightenment. So we're going to talk about these phenomena and look at some of the differences between them. So we'll start off with samsara first of all. I'll give you a couple of definitions. And the first definition I'm going to give you is the one that you would get from most of the Geshe's, the quite serious Dharma people. So if you look into a text and go, what is samsara? This is the definition you'll get from it. There are others, as we go through, I want to give you this one that all the teachers go, this is what samsara is. So samsara is, in brief, the cycle of a rebirth of the appropriated and contaminated aggregates that occurs under the control of karma and affliction. There's quite a mouthful there, and there's quite a lot of terms, of course, that we need to sort of become a little familiar with for this to make some sort of sense to us and be sort of valuable. This first thing, the cycle. So, you know, so cycles, they go round and round, they sort of repeat themselves. That's the idea. So something's being repeated here. So what's being repeated? Well, rebirth is being repeated. So it's a cycle of rebirth. So we are experiencing, well, we've been born, so here we are, right? We're experiencing the state of our birth. And as you know, as we're aging, aren't we? So here we are, going through this cycle of birth. But what it's sort of saying here is that there was a cycle before it, and there's going to be one after it. This thing just keeps repeating itself, rebirth. So what's being reborn? It's just the appropriated and contaminated aggregates. So these things have been reborn again and again and again, it's saying. So first of all, what are the phenomena called the aggregates? So aggregates are a simple way of putting it, they're just parts, they're things that make up other things. So if you look at a book, right, it's an aggregation of pages, a lot of pages, it's got a cover, it's got a back, it's just made up of parts, right? And then it's got pictures and writing. So we are made up of parts too. Simplest way of describing it is this, we've got like these two major parts, the body and the mind. But the Buddhists, what they do is they take the body and they go, yep, there's everything physical, but now the mind has got all these other parts of it. So they break it up into four parts. So you end up with five parts. These five parts are called the five aggregates. So we've got a body, that's the physical part. The mental part is called the mind. And the four parts I focus on there is feeling, discrimination, everything else that is not those two. So there you've got karma, the sense of self, time, area, all sorts of different things there. Love, hate, they're all put in there. And then finally you have the other thing called consciousness. So of course, feelings and discriminations are part of consciousness. You know, what they've done is just pull these two out. They go, like, these are really, really important. What we feel and then what we discern about those feelings. So in brief, what we call a person, a human being in our case, but you can also put it to an animal as well, is that they have a body and they have a mind. And this mind is basically made up of these four major parts. Feelings, discriminations, what they call compositional factors, and then, like I said, karma, the person, all different sorts of mental factors. And then we've got consciousness. And the consciousness is here, this word is referring to, is just our main six consciousnesses. Visual consciousness, auditory consciousness, olfactory consciousness, just those main ones that we all have. So these types of things. A body and a mind. That's the aggregates, the parts that make us up. But it says they're appropriated and contaminated. And this process of being appropriated and contaminated occurs under the control of karma and affliction. So Gaga, so now we've got a body and a mind that's being reborn again and again, and the process is occurring under the control of karma and affliction. Does that sort of make sense to you? Is that okay? Is it too much to pick up? The afflictions they're meaning here are the disturbing emotions which come out of this, out of ignorance. The disturbing emotions, or what they call afflictive emotions, afflictions, which are all rooted in a misapprehension called ignorance of who we are and how things exist. So this is the affliction part. We are afflicted because we've misunderstood, misapprehended, like who we are and how we exist. And then that goes, then we go out and everything else is the same thing. Now, when that takes place, like we don't just sit there and take it, right? We act upon it. So if the disturbing emotions are quite fearful, we'll run away from them, try and get away, or we're going to fight. So just a little bit of material about this. This is, most people have the belief that they are in control of their lives. However, we usually just repeat the same mental and physical patterns. And this cycle is called cyclic existence. It means we take on a new body and a mind repeatedly, and we do not choose this. Instead, our past actions and our current emotions are driving the process. Think of yourself as a collection of five parts, body, five aggregates. These parts include your physical body and your mental experiences. The definition says that these parts are contaminated. This means that a deep misunderstanding of reality clouds them. They are also appropriated. This is the interesting thing. This means we cling to them as mine because of our intense craving. And two main forces control the cycle. First, your past actions create the momentum for your future. And second, your disturbing emotions fuel the reactions. And these forces keep the wheel spinning. So I give it, there's a great analogy they use to describe this. So when we think of ourselves as a self, or as an I, a person, right? So is this person one person or many persons? Yeah, so it looks like right now. Just one. That's right. That's right. We don't think of ourselves as two or three people, right? We think of ourselves as one thing, right? Me. Here it's saying this one thing, self, is actually not. It's got five parts. It's not one thing, it's made up of these five parts. The example they give you is, and you would have seen this because there's people that do this activity in Brisbane, I've seen them. So they're called sort of fire dancers, and what they do is they get like a flaming torch and they whirl it. So what happens when they whirl it fast enough? What do you see? And there doesn't appear to be any parts in there, does it? It's one thing. Right? But then if it's sort of like you slow down, then where does the circle it sort of disappears, doesn't it? And all you see is just this one flame there. What you might call a false appearance here, isn't it? When it's moving really quickly, it looks like one big thing, it's like a big round circle. But when it stops, there's not a big round thing there called a round circle, just like one point of light. So we've got these five things aggregates, and they're going so quickly, like in and out of existence. And yet, here we all are. It doesn't look like that at all, does it? Looks like we're, I'd say, single persons. Sitting here, it doesn't look like there's any change taking place. But in effect, as we know, as we're just getting older, if you looked at pictures of yourself when you're perhaps as a baby in a photograph and look at yourself now, there's a massive difference, isn't it? And those changes have been going on like all the time. I'll just keep going. So is this part okay for you? Like this general part first, because I'll just keep going and we'll break it down. It gets more and more and more. So I'll just start here. We've got this thing called samsara is a cycle, meaning it goes Like the beginning point, and it stops and it starts up again, like any cycle does. So what's the cycle? The cycle of birth and death. We've been born for this life, we're living, death will take place, and we'll find ourselves reborn again and living and dying again. And it's just going to keep on going and going. This is what samsara is saying to me. So what's driving it? What makes it keep turning? Like I said, if you have the point of light and you're waving the finger around, it's the arm that keeps moving, isn't it? So what keeps driving this circle? So, well, it's karma and affliction. And what it's done, it's taken these five aggregates, or the body and mind, that is not under control of itself, it's under control of karma and delusion. And it's saying, this is me. But we appropriate it. The I says, this is me. Now, so here, I'm just going to stop and remind you of some things. Now, so when we talk about, if we ask ourselves, what is a person, or who is a person? We can point at one another and go, well, there's a person right there. If we ask ourselves, how does that person exist? You go, well, we've got a person and we've got a body and a mind. So what's the relationship between the person and the body and mind of the person? We can ask ourselves, is the person something separate from the body and mind? And then they appropriate it. It doesn't make sense if you think of that one, because what's going to happen if you think that, if the person is separate from their body and mind, then you're going to say, okay, so then things can happen to the body and mind and they wouldn't happen to me. Or things can happen to me and they wouldn't happen to the body and mind. You go, why? Because I'm separate. Not just like I've got a book here, right? I'm separate from the book. You sort of say, well, are you separate from your body and mind? Might feel that way sometimes, but then if you look at it, you go, well, if I was separate, just like the book is separate from me, I should be able to rip this book apart, but nothing's going to happen to me. So they go, yeah, I can. Yeah, well, now you try and rip your body and mind apart and go, and nothing will happen to me. You go, that doesn't happen. Something does happen to me. But so obviously, I'm not separate from my body and mind. So, does that make sense to you?
Yes, I've got a T-shirt that says "Body and Mind are One." Is that
Well, it depends what we mean by one.
true? Yeah.
So now we come to this next one. Body and mind are one and the same. Now, is that so? If we've got a body and a mind and the person, so these three things are one and the same thing. But that's the other option when a partner. And just as Carl's going out, no, that doesn't work out either. So if they're one, the body's a physical entity, right? You can go like this. You can't do that with a mind.
Would you feel it without a mind?
No. Yes, one dependent upon the other, but not one and the same.
Yes.
No, they're not separate and they're not one and the same. So how do you know? So, well, you take the position, you just say, okay, if they are separate, this would be the outcome. We look at that and go, well, that doesn't happen. Like I said, if we were separate from the body and the mind, right? So in other words, you might say, like this is my example often used, wow, it means that if I wanted to go to the toilet, I could go, but my body could stay here. Why? Because I'm separate from the body and the mind. I'm not the body, I'm separate from it. Is that the case? Can I actually do that? No. The other thing is that, like I said, if I were separate and slap my face, does it hurt me? And I'd have to say, of course it does. It doesn't just hurt the body, it hurts me. We would all say that, wouldn't we? So we can't be separate then, off like that. We're not, yeah, completely intrinsically different, what they mean. We're going to erase something. Like I said, the way we do this, we're looking here at this thing of going, is the self or the person, well, identity, what they call intrinsically the same, or meaning exactly the same as your body and mind? Or is it something completely different? So I said, if it is completely different, the body and mind could be harmed in any way, and you would not be. It's like I could rip this book up and I'm not ripped up, am I? But if I start, if you rip your body up, you're going to say, I'm all ripped up, aren't you? So it can't be separate. That's the first thing. Can't smile that thing out here. Then at Christmas, right, only we're the same. Seems like there's no other option, is there? So either different or the same. There's a type of analysis called a sevenfold analysis. What we're doing is just doing the first two, exactly the same or exactly or completely different. Then we go, do these aggregates exist within the self? Or does the self exist within the aggregates? Are the aggregates components of this self? And if they are, again, is the self within them or outside of them? Or is it them? But either way, we ask these questions. And what you find is it's none of them. It's neither the same, they're not intrinsically the same, and they're not intrinsically different. So then normally what happens is we're stuck, right? We go, what? I don't know. I seem to have run out of options. But what we're actually doing here is seeing this idea of, like, are they intrinsically the same or intrinsically different? Meaning exactly the same, no difference here, no relationship. The relationship, there's a relationship, one is completely different or completely the same. Could we exist in either of those ways? When you add these other things, you have seven different steps you can go through to do the analysis. You know, the outcome of this whole analysis is you find neither answer, neither place will leave you happy. It just leaves you, it's just confusing if you take that view. However, very, very few people do this type of analysis. So they nearly always think there's something different in their body and the mind, or they are one and the same. But this is how we think and behave without investigation, without analysis. When you do the analysis, you find, you're not either of those. Now, does this mean you don't exist? You go, no. Here I am thinking about it. Of course I exist. But what I've discovered is that I don't exist like this or like this. So, but that doesn't, you know, all I've discovered is how I don't exist. But still stuck with, like, how do I exist then? So we might not be able to come up with that answer straight away. Thank goodness for us, the answer is in the text. Then we just look at the text and then we can look at it and go, does that make sense? Is that a, you know, correct answer? So the answer is, the person is imputed to any of the four or five aggregates. So what does that mean? What it basically means is that we've got this phenomena called the body and mind, and they're called a person. They're called I. They're given the name I. So they exist with it together. We have a person. It's called a person or called self or called me or I. So the self is actually a name that is given to the body and mind. Now, if you think about that a little bit, you're going to go and realize, oh my God, it's like that for everything. Everything is like that. So this is how we actually exist. Huh? The self is merely imputed to the body and the mind. That's the actual way it exists. Now, what happens with samsara? How does samsara create it? Well, we think the I is more than the name. But we think it's like, is something in here, or is it something completely separate, or is it the body and mind? We can't find that. We don't get to the middle. But unless you do the analysis and become really familiar with it and go, but it can't be this way, it can't be that way. The only option left is it has to be just named, merely named. It's the only way. So that's how we're actually merely named. However, once this name is put onto the body and mind, like I said, then it seems like we forget it. It's like, no, the name is the body, is the mind, or it's something separate. As soon as you do that, then this whole thing kicks off. That's what kicks it off. Because it depends upon that. If you think you are the phenomena or you're something separate from it, just look at the phenomena, the body and the mind, what's going on there. Like, it has no control over itself. Mind has no control over itself, neither does your body. They're all under control of conditions that we have no control over. So once you grab onto your body and mind as being me, what you're saying, what you're doing, is you're grabbing hold of something that you have no control over. And man, what a calamity that's going to be, because that's what happens, right? Then all these things that we have no control over us start to happen to us. That's how the process sort of works. This only really became clear to me only a few months ago, right? Something really happened, and I was going, oh my God. Like I've been, you know, studying and teaching for like 30 years, right? And it was only just really recently, it was like, Jesus, that's what I'm doing. That's what it's getting at. Now, there's another, like I said, there's a number of different definitions. So this is the one that really all the Buddhist teachers will give you. This one here, it's, you know, as you can see, really condensed but hard to understand. You've got to sort of break it all up. But there's another one that Kinsa Rinpoche gave, and it's this, I really like this. He says, it's the powerless and repetitive ideas controlled by confusion and mental reactivity. So the most repetitive idea that we have is taking ourselves to be this body and mind, which is, or to be something different. And then from that, all the other ideas that follow, we call those ideas mine. If those ideas are threatened, what happens? You get upset. In fact, the word I itself, the name I, is just an idea given a name. That's all it is. Because like I said, it's nothing physical. You can't, you go right through your body, you'll never find your sense of I yourself and go, ah, oh, there it is. Because it's not physical. So it only leaves mental. You go through all the parts of your mind looking for an I. There's no such I there. So it can only, the I does exist. It's just that it doesn't exist as something physical. It's not something permanent. It's not something mental. But it's just a name or a label given to what they call the four or five aggregates, our body and mind, in other words. Now, if we look at how we actually live our lives, we'll find that we're not living. Our life is just our eye. Our sense of eye is just the name, are we? If we were, I don't think we'd get very upset when people said bad things about us, right? Because we don't, man, stop, you know, it's just the name, like everything. But this one here, I like this one here because you can really see this happening to yourself again and again. But you have ideas and they go, as you know, round and round. But so you have your circle of ideas going round and round. And you look at it, you ask yourself, is that what you really want to do with your mind? You want to stay awake at night and actually have your mind go round and round and round thinking about stuff that really doesn't contribute to your happiness? You probably will say no. But so also, and you ask them, well, are you actually doing it? You might say you are, but I'd question that and go, no, it's just the mind itself is doing it. You get the effects of it. You know, sometimes you say, I just can't go to sleep. You know, I want to go to sleep, but I can't go to sleep. Again, it shows you that like, you don't have control over the process. But while your mind is doing what it's doing, you can't sleep. You actually have to slow the mind down, don't you? Try to slow it right down, you come to your breathing, you do something, so you don't think like this. It's a half. Slowly through the breath, one, and then calm down. Then you try and go to sleep. And you wake up in the morning, bang, it's back up again. So I don't think any of you want to do that. I certainly don't want to do it, but it takes place. And this is like the process is not controlled by us. It's under the control of karma and affliction.
Two comments. Sandy says, Eddie, could you exchange the words name and label for description?
Yep. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that is. Give you an example. So we are just. It's process of imputation. And, you know, like I said, what's the person? The I. The person is an I imputed to. So the I is the name, or the label given to something else. Something else is what they call the basis for designating. You see this again and again in our lives. It's just, it happens so quick, I think so often we don't actually look at it as a process. You know, so in Australia, for instance, when the white people first came over here, right, and they're exploring the place, they're going to see a whole lot of stuff that has no name for them in English. So what was that great big red rock in the central Australia somewhere? So that is what they call a basis for a name. It's called a basis of designation. So when the white people came and they saw it, what did they call it?
Ayers Rock.
Ayers Rock, right? So who saw it? Mr. Ayer. That's what they normally do, isn't it? The explorer goes, oh, I see that thing. What's that? Nobody knows. I'll give it my name. So they call this big rock thing after myself. Other people come over from overseas, come here, don't they? They name like Sydney, right? You give it Sydney after Lord Sydney, who's in Great Britain somewhere, right? When we are born, we're just this little blob of flesh, right? You know, who's that? Well, nobody knows until your mum or your dad gives you a name. So the baby, the body and the mind, this little living being, is a basis for designating a name. And sometimes it's given Eddie or Mel or your own name. And so the name comes from your mum, and then very shortly you say, well, who are you? And you say, I am the name. So everything exists like that. If you think, oh, I'm not so sure about that, then you go, okay, well, this name is the identity we've given to this object. If it's not coming from me, where's it coming from? Where is it? Where is its identity? You might say, well, right there, what I'm looking at. Okay, just break that apart and find air or air's rock. So you don't find the name within the basis of designation. So you won't find your sense of I inside your body and mind, and you won't find it being the body and mind. Why? Because it came from, it was imputed to it, was given to it, it's not in there. It's not easy to get your head around it. That's why they often ask you to do the analysis. Go and look for yourself. Don't just listen to somebody tell you this. Take the point of view, okay, now I am. If I am, you know, this thing called the body, you know, then I'm physical. That means I should have some colour, shape, some sort of thing, and we go, that's me. Now, of course, science has never found any sort of person and say, well, that's the person. Sometimes people say the person is the brain. Other times they say it's the heart, don't they? And say, okay, so I is the heart. Which part? And then you get lost again, right? Because it's not that way. Identities are imputed or designated to a basis. So there's always two things here. There's something, and that something is going to be named. And then we know it as that. Shape. And you talk really more about the characteristics of the thing, aren't you? Not so much the thing itself. But to get to the thing itself, you've got to name that thing. So we sort of look at identities, and here we can look at the identity of our identity, right? What we call me or self or I. But if we look at this, you know, when we talk about suffering, we say, well, who's suffering? None of us are going to say, oh, the body's suffering. We say, no, I am, or she is. We point to the person and say, this person is suffering. And that's enough for us to all understand, isn't it, that the person is suffering. We don't have to understand it. Oh, the suffering and the person, are they one and the same or are they completely different? We don't do that type of analysis. We don't need to. We just go, no, conventional reality just looks like this. We just act. However, if you start to question it, then this whole thing just sort of falls apart. It doesn't have any coherence. So we come back to this idea that phenomena exist basically at its deepest level in mere name. So it's really interesting too when they use this term mere name. It means this name, the identity, can't be found within the object. That's why I call it merely named. Really, names means that when you look for the identity, which is the name, like we say, how does the I exist? You go, merely named, which means it is named, it's got an I, it's just its name, but it doesn't exist within the basis of designation. Yeah. The I is a label. The I is like a name we label upon something else, right? The something else is our body and mind. Same thing when these people found, like, you know, if you're an explorer in the old days, right, you're trying to find all these new things, right? And when you find them, they don't have any names, according to you. So they name them, and then they often say, now they belong to us, right? That's what you do when you go overseas and hop into different countries, right? You give it a name, and go, and that's mine. You might even draw a map up and say, see that? That's... Now, when we don't know this, or even if we know it, it's very difficult to unwind this habit, right? As people like we are, we do quite a lot of work to unwind the habit of seeing the name and the basis of designation being one and the same thing.
So, Eddie, my husband and I gave our two kids their names, but when they're really naughty or saying rude things to me, I suddenly don't remember that I gave them a name, and I think they're really there. Annoying me, and I'm really annoyed.
Yeah, and it's the same sort of thing happens all the time. As an example from this, you know, when people behave badly, you know, and we might call them an angry person. But so now we've got these two things, and we've got the person and the anger that we've imputed to them. Person has been imputed to this other base, remember, the body and mind, which is not under their control, which we don't know about. But we call them angry people. So when we say that to them, what does the person look like to us now? As an angry person, right? You give them that name, they're going to appear straight back to you like that. So then we've got a person and anger, we stuck them together and go, angry person. And whenever we think of them, we're going to think of them as angry people, right? People we don't particularly like to be around, because angry people are really uncomfortable to be around. So that's one response of looking at it, when we label them angry people. So anger is just another label we've wrapped on them. But again, just, you know, we forget that they get squeezed together. So this, when you can turn this to your advantage too. You know? So as Corrie said, once you realise that the person is not under control over their body and mind, so of course they're going to behave strangely, and that behaviour was we're going to call like anger. We could look at that and actually call that person, what might we say? We might say, that poor person, rather than that angry person, in the sense that that poor person has no control over their body and mind, and they're behaving in such a way that hurts themselves and others. But if we labelled them that way, we'd have more compassion for them rather than fear of them and aversion towards them. So this labeling process is terrifically powerful. Now, this one often, I remember when the first Buddhist I met, he said to me, when you're in company, keep an eye on your speech. When you're by yourself, keep an eye on your mind. But I was really shocked. I've never heard that before, and I asked him to repeat it. And I sort of started thinking about it, you know, and going, so when you're with others, you use words, you're imputing, throwing out language, and you think that the words have this meaning that's intrinsic to the word. Be really careful about how you do that, because it affects people, right? It'll affect you too. But when you're alone, it won't affect anybody else, it's just going to affect you. So you're talking to yourself using all these words and ideas, and there's meaning imputed to each one of them. And you do that, it's going to affect you. It's like you're sort of saying, Geraldine, to create the phenomena that create us and exist in the world, they require a number of different things, phenomena to exist. One of them is consciousness. Without consciousness, there's no way you can say whether people exist or not. Even with consciousness, so we have different types of consciousness, conceptual consciousness and perceptual consciousness. So suppose with my perception, I see you, Geraldine, right? But I don't know who you are. So what does that require? Name, conceptual consciousness. So I perceive you, first step. Next thing, I need to conceive of you. So I give you the name, Geraldine, or whatever it is. Huh? Now, when you do that, feelings are going to arise. Feelings. Yeah. Suppose I look at you and I go, oh, you look quite attractive. So have a nice, warm feeling towards you. Right? But if you don't, if I describe you as being Jesus, who is that for me, right? Now I get this other feeling. And now I'm averse to you. But if I just, in a whole group of people, I just do whatever, hi, yep, it's neutral. I have a neutral feelings towards you. So depending upon your conception and the perception, the naming process, feelings arise. Then it depends upon feelings, actions arise. But like, for instance, if I think, oh, Jesus, blah, 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 I have adverse feelings towards you. And I won't be thinking pleasantly of you, generally. But if I think, perhaps I'm having a really good day, you know, and I see I feel really warm towards you, I like you straight away. So I've got this feeling arise. But the whole thing has been like created, by us, by our mind. And you've got to remember here, the mind is not neutral here. It's got all its past experiences that come along with it. But so perhaps I've had some, perhaps I was in school, I had a teacher that looked like you and I didn't like her. Now I see you. And all my past comes up and shapes the way I look at you now. And so I'm going to respond, not really straight to you, but to my conception of you, my ideas of you, which really I don't know whether they're true or not. You know, they just spring into action. The past influences our present, and our present will influence our future. There are different synonyms and different analogies for samsara. So one of them is called cyclic existence. So you'll hear this term again and again. And when they talk, say, you cyclic existence, you don't talk about samsara. It's a disciple. It goes on and on. It's also called the pervasive dukkha of conditionality. So pervasive here means it goes across everything. And you go, well, what's everything, Eddie? You go, every realm that exists. So you could talk about, there's all sorts of ways to talk about this pervasive. So we talk about the realm of desire, which we find ourselves in. There's the formless realm and the form realm. They say, this type of suffering goes right across all of them. So this world we find ourselves in is a part of what they call the realm of samsara. So like this world, so in this world we have humans, we've got animals, we've got all sorts of living beings. And from a Buddhist perspective, there's quite a few other types of living beings too. There's all these beings are within this realm called the realm of desire. And the realm of desire is within samsara. The realm of desire has the pervasive dukkha of conditionality running all the way through it. So if you look at ourselves, we just looked at this and go, does this affect us? We go, yeah. Does it affect animals? Yeah. So it pervades all the beings with the five aggregates. But like I said, then it goes larger. Because you can look at the realm of desire where we are, but then you could go to other realms, go, let's look at the formless realm where beings don't have gross bodies like this. Do these people experience suffering? The answer is yes. No, that's in the realm of desire. It's always in the desire realm. These are other realms outside that.
Okay, these are realms outside of samsara.
No, they're included within samsara, but they're not within the desire realm. Yeah. So there's just different ways of describing, you know, the Buddhists have got different ways of categorizing and describing things. And you can go quite small and quite large. But they're sort of saying here, this dukkha of conditionality, because we are conditioned by karma and delusion, we find ourselves within samsara. So think of samsara is not out there. What you might call, you look out there, they also call suffering, is called true sufferings. And there's a difference between true sufferings and samsara. It just gets deeper and deeper. So these are really nice ones I like. So Trungpa Rinpoche means, this is samsara, means it's all mixed up. Everything gets mixed up. He says, it's a bit like having, you go to somebody's place for dinner and they serve you a soup, but there's steak in there and there's fish and there's some jelly and some bubble gum. It's just like everything is just stuck together and stirred up like this. You go, there you go. So that's your samsaric life, right? That's what mind is doing. So, like I said, the thing is, like, you got the idea is there's a lot of stuff mixed up and stirred around. That's one. There's another one. I like this one too. It's not quite right. So, who bought this? Geshe Sultram, didn't he? So, his teacher asked him, what is described to me what's called samsara? And of course, you give all sorts of answers, but they don't want the answers from the text. They want a lived example. Tell me from your own experience what samsara. So I give you the textual answer at the very beginning, but you also want to try and bring something that's personally meaningful to you. And this is the one where it's just not quite right. Things never quite work out.
Yeah.
So I remember this thing, I remember my nephew. He was a boxer, and I asked him, so what's the goal here? And he says, I want to have this championship and win it. I said, great, okay. I said, so when you win it, I said, your joy is going to last for about that long. Yeah. And what's going to happen is all your friends are going to come up to you and think that you're great. And they're all going to tell you about how great you are, but inside, you're going to feel there's something missing, something's not quite right. And lo and behold, that's exactly what happened. He won the boxing. He was jumping up and down the ring, and I was watching him. And then he come out of there, and it's like, what's it feel like now, mate? And he said, like, what? Said, up there and here, what's the difference? Is there any difference? He goes, yeah. So that's right. That high has already disappeared. Now you're back to normal. Everything's like this. Just check your own mind, right? Whatever, if you feel great, believe me, it's like it's the name you put in, next minute, second, it's like already dissipating. We find this all the time. So, most of us walk around, our world is like sort of what we call normal, but it's a bit neutral, isn't it? We don't really feel high, we don't really feel low. But we know they can change. The finger snap, in fact. And so, this is not quite right. Right. Things aren't stable. They change all the time. This other teacher called it sad. And this is another one I like, right? Because sad is just an acronym that means striving, accomplishment, disappointment. If you want to own a house, strive, you work hard, you get the house. And then you're in it, and now it's all ordinary, normal. And then we need a bigger house, we need something else. Yeah. So this is what normally happens with our mind. Demi.
Sandy asks, samsara is not a place, hey? No, and realms are more like experiences?
Yeah, you can see, that's right. Yeah. Got carried away on that first one. Sure. Next thing is, what exemplifies it? So here's another interesting way of talking about it. So true sufferings are the five appropriated contaminated aggregates. It's also seen that these are samsara. I just want to see. This has three elements. That which is bound. Okay, so what is bound within cyclic existence? What is bound within samsara? The answer is us. the I, the sense of self. Self is bound. To what is it bound to? The five appropriate contaminated aggregates. Like I said before, no, we're just a name, but we take this name to be more than that, and we grab onto this body and mind and go, that's me. So now the I is bound to it. We are bound to something that's in the nature of suffering. So we must suffer then, eh? If we do that. It's like if you know fire burns and you grab it and you hold on to it, the fire burns. You're going to get burnt. You grab onto something that's actually not yours, these fire aggregates or the contaminant, you're going to get suffering because they are in the nature of suffering. They have no control over themselves. They're under the control of karma and delusion. And that is, that's what's binding them. That's what I only got just recently. You know, it was really sort of shocking. And then it was really good too. It was like, oh, that's how it's happening. And that's how you can also become free. Right? It was because, like I said, we are not the five appropriate contaminated aggregates. We're not them. We're not something separate from them. What binds us to it is our own misapprehension that we are them, when in fact we're not. So, you know, if you know the nature of fire is hot and burning, and we pick up something that's hot and burning, what's going to happen to us?
Pain.
Yeah, so pain. So if we didn't want to feel that pain, what do we have to do? Let it go. That's right, we have to let it go. Same too, if we grasp at these contaminated aggregates of body and mind and don't want to suffer, what do we have to do? Let it go. Aggregates are body, feelings, discrimination, compositional factors, and consciousness.
Oh, they ask, if you're experiencing something not quite right,
yeah,
can you actively change this samsara or this samsara?
Well, you can help. If you're talking about somebody else and you're trying to help them, of course you can help them do it. Yeah, and this is what the purpose of the Dharma is. If we find ourselves, then we have to go back to the Dharma, because that's, you know, to hold on to the Dharma rather than to hold on to samsara, right? They're against each other. We oppose one another. So this one, so you're going to hold on to something that actually opposes this world, these wrong views, the Dharma. Well, I've been talking much too long about those first slides. So you guys have been asking some questions. Is there anything else you'd like to ask about this material? Yeah, no, it does sound really grim. It's true. And I remember, in fact, when Robina used to be here and she'd be quite, that nature of suffering, I'd just go, oh, you know, it sounds like there's no way out. It does sound like that. But again, it's like I was saying about this, using the analogy, yeah, but if you don't want to have a hot coal burning, you have to drop it. They say, let it go. And this is the idea. We have to let go of the wrong ideas that we have about ourselves. It's not an easy thing to do. Well, it's not easy for me to say this. But if we've been in the habit of a wrong idea for a long time, right? It's not easy to drop these wrong ideas, is it? But that's what we have to do. And of course, the way that they do it is that first of all, you get a correct understanding, like we're getting now, hopefully. But when it comes to actually drop it properly, it requires a little bit more than that. Like you have to sort of get some direct insight into it, direct knowledge. When you see, oh my God, it's not that way at all, then you have real deep confidence in it. Like I said, what I mean here is like the deep confidence that when you don't find your sense of self within the aggregates or being the possessor of them, then you know, right? You're not that. And it's not the case that you don't exist, because here you are thinking about it, so you must exist. It's just like, how? Then we come to this imputation. Then you can sort of say, oh my God, if that's related to me, then it relates to everything else. I impute labels and names on things. I give them meaning. They come back at me as if they exist from their own side, but they don't. We've got to let this one go. We just do our last meditation because I've taken too long. Now, when you want to stop samsara from occurring, this is called renunciation. And this comes about, since renunciation is an uncontrived, spontaneous aspiration to definitely emerge from cyclic existence and achieve liberation. So it's the uncontrived, spontaneous aspiration. So aspiration means a wish. You have a wish to get out of the situation you find yourself in, this samsaric situation. You have to want to have that. This is, it's an uncontrived, spontaneous wish. Before we can develop this uncontrived, spontaneous wish, we have to, what they call, contrive a wish, or generate a wish. And to do that, you need to use reasoning. So that's what I've just been doing. We have to look at samsara first. You go, okay, that's samsara. You want that to keep happening? You're going to go, if you go, no, okay, there's your wish. I don't want that to keep happening. Then you're going to find yourself, well, why do I keep creating the causes for it again? So this is where you have to sort of get down to this uncontrived, spontaneous wish. And I often give the example of driving a car, right? So before you drive a car, you've got to get that rule book. And, it takes a lot of work, doesn't it? You've got to think it through. When you're in the car, everything's sort of slow, bit by bit, until you get good at it. And then you hop in and you don't have to think about it. You just do it. That's like this. It's the wish, but it doesn't involve all the conceptual stuff before it. Why? Because you've already done that. It's like, one of the examples when I was growing up with cars, why do young men want to have cars? What was one of the reasons given? So they can pick up young women. Right? So that's the reason. What else? Yeah, you can go to other parts of the country, can't you? America's got freedom. So you've got all these reasons for it. Right? And they're in there and you go, I want a car. I don't need to use all those reasons anymore. I want a car. Right? I've already got the reasons. I want a car. So when you look at samsara and you see it's how much suffering is involved, and it is possible to get out, then you go, I want to get out there. And so that's always there with it. I often describe it as being like a prisoner in a cell. So what I found really funny with people who are locked up, how much they really want to be free. And often what drives their freedom, their wish to be with their families. So they have this, they want to be out of their prison situation, and they also want to be with the family. This one here, Jindran Renan, says, I want to be free from the state I'm in and therefore be liberated. So liberation is another name for this type of freedom. But here again, this is the way they describe it in the text. So liberation is the true cessation in the continuum of an arahat who has abandoned all afflictive obscurations and their seeds without exception. So again, another huge definition and quite a mouthful. And again, we've got to break it down again. So a cessation, anybody heard the word before, cessation? Okay, what do you think it means?
A ceasing
of. Yeah, a ceasing of, a stopping of something. That's exactly right. Something has stopped. So we say, so it's a true stopping, meaning it's never going to come back again. Because this stopping, this is the cessation. This is not just stop and come back. It's no, stopping, never coming back. In the continuum of an arahat, so in the continuum means in the mind of somebody. If somebody is the arahat, This person has abandoned all afflictive obscurations and their sins without exception. So within their mind stream, then, they have no causes for anger, any cause for a disturbing emotion. All the causes have been stopped. Because the causes have been stopped, the afflictions cannot arise again. So this reminds me of another example I can give you. So there's been many instances throughout history where people have grown up with a woman they think is their mother, and she's not. But it turns out that the woman they thought was their mother was actually their mother's sister. So that's happened a few times, right, throughout history. So imagine you're that person, right? You think that this woman here is my mother. You think that. But then you find out, actually, she's not. Could you ever go back to thinking that she was your birth mother?
No.
No, that idea has stopped. You never go back there. It's the same. So when you find out that you're actually not your body and mind, and you're not something separate from them, the idea that you are something separate or the same as never comes back. So that calls liberated from that, from the belief that you are your body and mind, or that you're something separate from them. That idea will not come back. And the answer for why that is because you've seen directly that you are not your body and mind or something separate. Just like when this woman who was actually not your mother tells you, darling, I'm not your mother. In fact, I'm your mother's sister. It's the same thing when you have a lie and a truth, right? Once the lie is exposed, you can't believe the lie anymore, is it? If the lie has been exposed and you now know the truth, and then somebody tells that lie again, are you going to go back to, oh, yeah? Don't do that. So it's the same sort of thing. Our mind has been telling us a lie for a long, long time. We've exposed that lie. We don't go back to it and grab it and hold on to it.
It's like, as a kid, you believe in Santa.
Yeah.
And then you found out that Santa's not true. You're not
going to
go back and believe
it. No,
Santa.
No, that's right. All that idea, Santa was climbing down the chimney, yeah. Right? You know, and you go, we don't have a chimney. Yeah, it's like that. This is the idea. You know, we have a wrong idea about who we are and how we exist. When we don't have that wrong idea anymore, we're liberated from that wrong idea. We're in a liberated state from the wrong idea. This is what this term sort of means. And so now we have this other term called nirvana. So there are a number of different nirvanas. Now, I didn't want to go too deeply into this, but first one I want to talk to is what they call a natural nirvana. This is described as the ultimate nature of a mind that is primordially pure and devoid of inherent existence. So what this means is that the inherent existence the mind seemed to have, or seems to have, it doesn't have that. So the mind does not have inherent existence, it has dependent existence. So the mind dependently exists, it says it's primordially pure. So what does that mean? It means that the afflictions, all of our disturbing emotions, the wrong ideas we have, aren't in the nature of the mind. They're actually imputed to the mind, just like everything is. But as soon as you do it, it affects the mind. So there isn't any. So the deepest nature of mind here, they're saying, is without inherent existence, which means it dependently arises. And all the disturbing stuff is not of the deepest nature of the mind. Here again, another analogy might help. You know, when you have muddy water. And so the water looks dirty. And it is, it says dirty, isn't it? Question is, can that dirt be removed from the water and you can drink the water? And the answer is yes. Why? Because the dirt is not of the nature of water. So the afflictive emotions aren't of the nature of the mind. Again, the example I often give you is like clouds in the sky, right? Yes. You go, yeah, the clouds cover the sky, but they're not the nature of sky. So it's the same with us. Our disturbing emotions cover the mind, get us into all sorts of problems, but they're not of the nature of it. If they were of the nature of the mind, there would be nothing we could do about them. Just like we have dirty water. If the mud was of the nature of the water, nothing we can do about it. It's not. So now all phenomena are naturally empty, meaning that they have this term called natural nirvana. All phenomena, the wood, everything around us is naturally empty. That's this. So you go, okay, it's all naturally empty and dependently existent. So they're naturally empty of an independent existence, therefore they must dependently exist. Now, nirvana, this is the ultimate nature of the mind. So this, so like I said, so when we, although phenomena are naturally empty or natural nirvana, nevertheless, just like the nature of water being clear and, you know, as you know, mud can cover it. Once you take the mud out of the water, now you have the clear water. You have a mind that's actually clear and knowing. You remove the wrong conceptions you have from that mind, you end up with its ultimate nature. So the nirvana here is referring to the ultimate nature of mind. So again, nirvana is the emptiness of the mind that has been totally cleansed of obscurations. And here we have a sort of a metaphor. So samsara is this, like I said, the cycle, what they often call like a race. And you often see those pictures of hamsters running on the wheel. Yeah, that's samsara. That's what we're like, right? Trying to be happy, doing the same things. So that's the race. Liberation is not when you stop doing that. Right? That's our finish line. But nirvana is the area beyond it. It's what they call a state of peace. And I particularly like this quote. This guy says, like, samsara is mind turned outwardly, lost in its projection. Nirvana is mind turned inwardly, recognizing its nature. Again, the mind, what you focus it upon and how you focus it. Now we have another term called non-abiding nirvana. So when you come across this term, you're going to see it a lot in the text. However, its meaning is different depending upon the type of text you read. So if you're reading material from the Pali tradition, they have a way of describing what nirvana is. And if you read it from the Sanskrit tradition, they have a way of explaining it. So this center is sort of based around the Sanskrit tradition. But I want you to know that there are different ways of explaining these concepts and looking at them. So we talk about like how, as you know, so we are in samsara, right? Now, if we were to get out of samsara, we could be one of two types of person. We could be either an arahat or we could be a Buddha. Now, the arahats, they abide within nirvana. And they abide in the state of peace. But a Buddha exists in what they call a non-abiding nirvana. So the Buddha does not abide within nirvana, in that peaceful state. You know, why? What stops him from doing that? Any idea? Their compassion. It's compassion that stops you abiding in the state of peace, right? Does the Buddha abide in samsara then? You go, no. So they're not in samsara and they're not in the nirvana of the arahat. But it's called, so they abide, it's called the non-abiding nirvana. They have a state of peace, but it's pervaded with compassion. And this compassion gets them out to keep working for others. And of course, the state is called Buddhahood. And in that state, they have achieved, but it's one way you can describe it, a very simple way, is called perfect fulfillment for oneself and others. So if somebody asks you, what is a Buddha, you can say somebody who's fulfilled their own needs and the needs of others. And briefly, the relationships. So here we have samsara and cyclic existence, as we know. It's a cycle of rebirth of the contaminated and appropriate aggregates that occurs under the control of karma and afflictions. That was our first slide, right? Describing it. Then, to be free of it, we need to generate what we call renunciation, this really firm wish to escape. That state, once it's achieved, is called nirvana, or liberation. You can see it's a state of cessation in which the true causes of suffering and suffering itself have been eradicated completely. So you have the state of called nirvana. However, you can go further than that and achieve what others would like also to help them do that. How are you feeling? Are you more confused than we began, or sort of not too bad? Okay, let's do our last meditation, our one and only meditation for today, because I've talked so much, so didn't do it as well as I'd like to. Please, so get comfortable in the seat. So your spine is straight, your shoulders are relaxed, and you let the body is breathing itself. And now's the time to set an altruistic motivation. So you can use this time to find a peaceful state of mind that helps you and others. So imagine if you could be in the middle of a really busy day and feel as calm as a mountain lake. So the central insight to draw from this is that true freedom means being completely present in the world without being entrapped by it. When we understand that we can actually do this, we don't need to run away from the problems we face in life. In fact, we can meet them with an open heart. So imagine your mind is like this clear mountain lake. And on its surface, it reflects the clouds. And the clouds, of course, are moving through the sky, but the lake itself moves nowhere. It stays where it is, still. So what if the stresses you meet daily are just like reflections on the surface of that watery lake? The reflection of clouds doesn't even enter the lake. Its movement has no power over the lake. Our own reflections have no substantial reality. They have no weight. From the point of view of the surface of the lake, which is smooth and still, it remains that way even while the clouds move through the sky. So throughout the day and the rest of the evening, do your best to try to relax as much as possible and not cling to your ideas, not cling to your perceptions. Do your best to just relax and let them come and let them go. And breathing in through your nostrils, just exhale. try to hold on to one of those definitions of samsara, one that works for you. And then you rub that one and try and look at the others and see, can I get something out of that definition? Like I say, I've been, like you know, I've been teaching nearly 30 years now, and it's only like in the last couple of months that this thing suddenly went boom. Oh my God, it's like that. So it does take time, that's for sure, and it differs for each one of us. Yeah, so like I said, as we go through this course, we'll go into more depth and show you like why it's actually possible to be free. And in a way, we've always been free. It's like a prisoner with a door open, but we're just pushing the wrong way. You know, we're trying to push out, we just pull the door inwards and we're free. In those, the books that you might have, or if he's giving away, there's a section there called renunciation. Have a little read of that. Try and get two definitions of samsara. You might say sad, or it's not quite right, or like, you know, it's like a soup made up of all these parts. Try and get a couple of work for you. And next week we start to look at these what they call the four noble truths, or the four truths of the noble beings, and ask this question: why is it taught that way when causes come before their effects? Now, we know the four noble truths are taught. Effect, cause. The question is, why is it taught that way when we know causes come before effect? The Buddha taught effect first, but causes come first. Why is he teaching it this way? So have a look at that next week. Then let's dedicate this material. So I think you know, you have been sitting here listening and paying attention and asking questions. So let's develop some sort of mental energy. It's directed towards the goal of total freedom for ourselves and having that ability to help others do the same. So please join me in saying these prayers. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme dual bodhicitta not yet born arise at birth. May that born have no decline but increase forevermore. And as long as space remains, as long as sentient beings remain, may I too remain to the style of the silence of the world. In the prayer for His Holiness as well, Lord. The wish granting, wish fulfilling Dura, source of every single benefit and happiness in this world, to the incomparably kind Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech, may all your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. And then the prayer for Rinpoche's return. In holding and spreading the Buddha's precious and complete teachings through explanation and practice, you wore the armor of patience that is never discouraged, the incomparable Emerald Guru, to you, Amitabha.